This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran hits out at the Ukrainian president's remarks against Tehran, saying he should learn a lesson from the fate of countries that relied on the U.S. Thousands of ambulance workers in the U.K. are to stage a walkout in January amid escalating dispute with the government over pay. And a diplomatic blow to Israel. Chile's president says the government is planning to boost its official representation in Palestinian territories to embassy.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Tehran has condemned the repeated accusations by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of sales of Iranian drones to Russia to be used in the Ukraine war. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani reiterated that Iran has not provided drones to any side of the war in Ukraine. He said the Islamic Republic respects the sovereignty of all countries, including Ukraine. Kanani said Zelensky needs to learn a lesson from the fate of the countries that relied on the United States for support. The spokesman's remarks are in response to the Ukrainian president's speech in the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. Zelensky again accused Iran of sending drones to Russia and hundreds threatening the country's crucial infrastructure. Tehran dismisses the allegation, calling them part of Washington's propaganda campaign against Iran. American political analyst Andrew Curry explains why President Volodymyr Zelensky has doubled down his claims that Iran provides Russia with weapons.
Zelensky is trying to compete with the Israeli lobby in the United States because Zelensky is the front man of the anti-Russian lobby. And both of these lobbies are competing for billions of dollars of American federal funding each year. Up until this year, with the start of the special operation that Russia was provoked into commencing to defend its national security red lines in Ukraine after NATO crossed them there, Israel was receiving about $3 billion per year, and that was more or less consistent. Up until the evacuation from Afghanistan last year, you had operations related to the so-called war on terror receiving several billion dollars as well, and so on and so forth. And that would actually sometimes be a lot higher, depending upon the year. Whereas the anti-Russian lobby wasn't receiving all that much. But with the start of the special operation, the anti-Russian lobby has received thus far, in terms of the public budget, not even counting the black budget, which is related to intelligence operations. Zelensky was trying to find a way to preemptively avert the Israeli lobby chipping into this all these funds that his lobby has received by trying to find some kind of common ground using Iran. But I believe the entire pretext is specious, it's fake, and it's just designed to actually manipulate the Israeli lobby, which is the anti-Russian lobby's top competitor right now.
Pakistan's parliament has summoned the MPs belonging to the former prime minister and the PDI party in person for confirmation of their resignations. The lawmakers, however, have not appeared before the custodian of the National Assembly to tender their final resignations. Nasser Kazmi reports.
The Pakistani government called a fresh session of the parliament on Thursday evening after the MPs affiliated to the ex-prime minister's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party requested the Speaker of the National Assembly for the acceptance of their resignations. The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly. terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to Treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former prime minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 23rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thousands of ambulance workers in the UK are to stage additional walkouts in January following their first industrial action on Wednesday. According to the Unition Trade Union, the new strikes will be staged on January 11th and 23rd, and escalating disputes with government will have been the reason. It added that while Wednesday's strike started 12 hours ago, the two strikes next month will last 24 hours each. The walkouts will involve all ambulance employees as opposed to just emergency response crews. The new strike came as the country's health system is already under strain this winter, with nurses also going on strike in separate pay dispute. Trade unions have asked for a rise of above the inflation rate, which has stood at 10.7% in November. The decades high inflation rate in the UK has led to the worst cost of living crisis in a generation. The government, however, insists that it must stick to more modest increases for the public sector workers recommended by independent pay review bodies. And in a diplomatic blow to Israel, Chile's leftist president says his government will upgrade its official representation to Palestine to embassy.
We are going to upgrade Chile's official representation in Palestine from the business manager we have today to an embassy we will open during our term to give Chile the representation it deserves and be present in all the diplomatic spaces in Palestinian territories.
He made the announcement while speaking in a meeting with the Palestinian community in Chile. Reports says the community can count on him as a friend. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also strongly commended the move. It says that the decision affirms the principled position of Chile in supporting international law and the right of Palestinians to establish their own state. Chile has a large Palestinian population outside of West Asia, which is estimated more than 300,000. The South American country opened a representative office in the occupied West Bank of Ramallah in 1988 and recognized Palestine as a state in 2011. Chile also is supposed to support Palestine's accession to the UNESCO. Peru's president has called for a visit from inspectors of a regional human rights body who are in the country's probe of widespread civil unrest. Pedro Castillo demanded an urgent meeting with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. He said he had been arbitrarily deprived of his rights. The Rights Commission says that its technical team on the ground in Peru has received information on violations of human rights in the context of protests. Peru has been embroiled in violent protests since the removal of the president Castillo earlier this month. Castillo was trying to dissolve Congress and rule by decree after lawmakers sought to impeach him. Daniel Burrete, Peru's vice president, has become the country's president. Peru's Congress still has decided to move up the general elections from 2016 to 2024, a bid to ease the tensions. Russia and China holding joint military drills in the South China Sea. Moscow says that these exercises are aimed at withstanding new regional challenges and threats. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Russia says its joint naval drills with China are a natural response to the aggressive buildup of the U.S. military in the Asia-Pacific region. Valery Gerasimov, the Russian army chief, said unlike Washington, Moscow and Beijing are not after creating any alliances and new dividing lines in the region. He said the purpose of the drills is to ramp up combat readiness of both countries and the ability to withstand new regional challenges and threats. Russia and China kicked off their week-long maneuvers in the East China Sea on Wednesday. The military exercises, dubbed Joint Sea 2022, would involve missile and artillery firing at air and sea targets, as well as submarine operations. Joint naval drills between Russia and China have become regular since the year 2012. Moscow aims to boost its cooperation with Beijing amid tensions with the West over Ukraine. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Leesburg. We also have Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. William Jones, I'll start with you first. These military exercises between Russia and China have been going on since the year 2012, but of course now they play a more significant role in the message that it's sending. First of all, who are the perceived threats, as the report indicated, which may be one reason why they're holding these military drills?
Well, there are obviously a number of threats. One, of course, is the decision by Japan to effectively quadruple its defense budget in the next 5 years, against a lot of opposition from people who feel that this is going to be raising a lot of taxes in Japan. But that's the intention, and that's in coordination with the United States, which has made Japan a much greater ally as an extension of this so-called Indo-Pacific strategy. There are also discussions between Japan and NATO, which also sends a signal that NATO may very well be expanding into the Asia Pacific. You had also the visit by President Zelensky to the United States to really raise more money for fighting Russia in Ukraine. And all of these, of course, have created danger signals for both China and Russia, who are both targets of this so-called new strategy, have been clearly designated as rivals, competitors by the United States, and that therefore they are taking action in regard to this. I think it's very important now that the facilities which are being used, military facilities on the ships and the airplanes involved in this, are of the highest quality. There's a very close relationship in terms of strategy and fighting. It gives also the Russians an opportunity to feel the area in which they may be engaged at some point in the future, together with the Chinese, and also gives a greater comfort zone between Chinese and Russian forces in working together to fend off a potential foe. But I think the reason it's being done is that the war fever is coming to a high threshold in the West by the decision of the U.S. government to give how many billions of dollars to Ukraine to continue this war against Russia, which essentially is a NATO proxy war. So the troubling times create a reaction of this nature, and that the Chinese and the Russians intend to be united and prepared if this gets out of control as a result of the West's attitude.
Gilbert Doctorow, how worried should the U.S. and its allies be?
Oh, they should be worried. I mean, this is a very unsubtle signal that at any moment the United States and its allies could face a two-front war. That is, the war in Ukraine, where Russia is predominant, and a flare-up in the Chinese-Taiwan situation, which would place the Americans also under military stress in order to live up to the promises that they have made to Taiwan to look after its security. This takes place in a particular context where Western leaders have attempted to portray Russian-Chinese relations as fraying, where in his recent visit to Beijing, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz came back with a statement that the Chinese leader had been very critical of the Russians for their threats to use nuclear arms. And it was Mr. Scholz was hinting at a split between the Russians and the Chinese. This is a hoped-for development which has no substantial basis to it. And the ongoing naval maneuvers, joint exercises between the Russians and the Chinese, highlight the intensity of their military cooperation, even if there is no formally declared alliance or bloc formed.
Thank you so much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review. Gilbert Doctor, our pleasure. Independent International Affairs Analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on to new reports by the Centers for Disease Control show life expectancy in the U.S. has hit its lowest in the past 25 years. According to reports, the average life expectancy for Americans shortened by over 7 months last year. That decrease followed another decline of 1.8 in 2020. The expected lifespan Americans now stand at 76.4 years, which is the lowest since 1996. The COVID-19 pandemic and the overdoses mostly caused by synthetic drugs so were mentioned as the main factors causing the drop in U.S. life expectancy. In August, the CDC released a report predicting the worst two-year decline of life expectancy on record in the U.S. since 1923. Life expectancy in the U.S. remains lower than other industrial countries, although it has the highest money allocated to health care.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's shoot-to-kill policy has been widely criticized as the number of Palestinian deaths at the hands of its forces increases. According to multiple reports, Mohammad An Mohannad Yusuf Muteir were fixing a tire when an Israeli settler rammed his car into them. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, two Palestinian brothers were killed after an Israeli settler rammed into them in the occupied West Bank, according to multiple Palestinian sources. The brothers Mohammad and Mohannad Yusuf Mutayr from the Qalandia refugee camp in Al-Quds were killed recently just south of the West Bank city of Nablus. A car driven by a 50-year-old Israeli man hit the vehicle belonging to the two brothers, which had parked on the side of the road, according to the Zionist regime's emergency service, Magen David Adom. The brothers were fixing a puncture tire when the settler drove his vehicle into them, the Wafa news agency reported. Mohammad Mutayr died at the scene and Mohannad Mutayr was pronounced dead at the Hadassah hospital in Al-Quds. Palestinian politician Mohammad Shatayeh called the attack a horrific crime. Palestinian news outlet said that the two brothers had been with their family in Nablus preparing for their sister's wedding. Qalandia announced a general strike. In a press statement, the director of Al-Quds Governorate Office in Qalandia, Zakaria Fayala, said the settler deliberately sped up his car and rammed into the brothers, killing one on the spot. Hanan Ashrawi, a Palestinian lawmaker, called the latest incident a hit-and-run murder, adding more hashtag Israel crimes with impunity. Earlier this week, the Israeli regime army confirmed killing a 15-year-old Palestinian girl during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The U.S. has called for accountability following the killing. The latest deaths come amid a spike in Israeli regime violence against Palestinians in the West Bank this year and a resurgence of Palestinian armed resistance. Since the beginning of the year, the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime forces has risen to 218, including 52 in the Gaza Strip and 166 in the West Bank, making it one of the deadliest years on record for Palestinians since 2005. The Zionist regime has recently been conducting raid and arrest operations across the West Bank on a near daily basis, often killing or wounding Palestinians in the process. The operations have resulted in more than 2,500 arrests, according to the Zionist regime authorities. Many of the deadly raids have occurred in the Jenin and Nablus areas. The Zionist regime's shoot-to-kill policy has been widely slammed as the number of Palestinian deaths at the hands of its forces increases. Meanwhile, Tasnim News Agency reported that Israeli regime forces shoot dead teenage Palestinian girl in Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that a teenage Palestinian girl was killed by Israeli regime troops in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Jana Majdi Isam Zakarna, 16, was on the roof of her home when she was shot in the head by Israeli regime troops, according to the ministry. Sources told Anadolu Agency that clashes broke out when Israeli regime forces carried out raids in eastern Jenin city to apprehend a juvenile. Three more Palestinians shot by Israeli regime forces were being treated at the Ibn Sina Hospital in Jenin, the Palestine Red Crescent said in a statement. Three others were detained in the Israeli regime raids, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Club. The Zionist regime forces have recently been conducting overnight raids and killings in the occupied West Bank cities, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Over 210 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime forces in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of the year. Local and international rights groups have condemned the Zionist regime's excessive use of force and shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians. Incidents of sabotage and violence by settlers against Palestinians and their property have also become a daily occurrence throughout the occupied territories, particularly in the West Bank. However, the Zionist regime authorities rarely prosecute settlers, and the vast majority of the files are closed due to deliberate police failure to investigate them properly.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and a special hello to our Christian listeners, for the benefit of whom we present a wonderful passage found in the Islamic text that evoked the prophecy of Jesus in the Gospel of St. John regarding the Paraclete, or the last and greatest of God's messenger, whom Ayah 6 of Surah Saf of the Holy Quran specifically says is Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Thus I charge you, O son of Mary, that you bring news to the children of Israel of the master of the messengers and my most endeared, who is Ahmad, having a red camel and a face like the moon, who is a shining light, a pure heart, courageous, venerably modest. Verily, he is a mercy to the worlds, and master of the children of Adam, on the day of his meeting me, the most honored of the foremost, and the last of the messengers from me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, family pathology and emotional trauma. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the family pathology and emotional trauma in the Islamic lifestyle. Islam gives importance to the family life, to the formation of family. Therefore, it is necessary to have the family pathology and to know about the reasons and effects or the causes that is weakening this formation of the family or the bond of the family. So the first reason is the emotional trauma that we see. We gave some examples in the previous episode, but here we're going to talk about the other examples. For example, Islam forbids the use of alcohol. Why? Because when someone is using the alcohol, they drink beer or alcoholic drinks, it takes away their senses for a time. And in that time, when this person is dealing with his kids, with his wife, with his parents, he is out of mind. He does not know what is he saying. So it causes, especially in the relation of husband and wife, it causes the difficulties between these two people. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said it forbids from using the alcohol in all cases. And obviously, the one who uses the alcohol, obviously, after that, sometimes they do not take care of the hygiene. They become psychic for some time. They cannot live without it. Therefore, Islam has stopped us from using the alcohol. Why? Because the very first thing that it does is that it harms the relationship within the family. It harms the relationship between the brother and sister, between the husband and wife, between father and daughter, between the family members, brother and brother, father and son. So therefore, we need to make sure that even living in the West, with the Western style, we should avoid the things that are forbidden in Islam because it is for us and we want to have a pure Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of family pathology and emotional trauma. We said that Islam has forbidden the alcohol and we should avoid it in order to have a good family relation. And the things that are forbidden in Islam, we should always avoid such things. The other thing which is causing the weakness of the family formation, and it comes under the category of emotional trauma, is that when someone leaves or does not perform the obligations, for example, if salat or namaz or the prayer, daily prayers, is wajib, it is an obligation, we must perform it. In a family, we must perform the daily prayers. So it is necessary to protect ourselves from disobeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, even in the Quran, when we see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said in the chapter Tahrim, verse number 6, Allah said, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O those who believed, قُوْ أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. Save, protect yourself and your family from the hellfire. The hellfire in which the fire is, the fuel is the people themselves and the stones. Therefore, it is necessary to perform all the obligations. It is, when we say like the religious obligations, it means like if in the Islam it is said that the backbiting is haram, it is forbidden, we should not perform this. You know, in the family, we should not backbite about our relatives, our brothers, sisters, or family members, or even, you know, the people in the society. And on top of that, we should not go after the privacy of the others. So we should avoid all these things. We must avoid all these things so that if we avoid such things, then obviously we can have the good Islamic lifestyle. We should avoid the reproach, and these things causes the weakness of the family. And Islam talks about a firm family system, and that's why it stops us from such things, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
the child of the border.
Part 1.
Here is my homeland, which in the not-too-distant past was populated by caring, welcoming, and hard-working people. An era when there was neither a weapon nor opium, neither insecurity nor massacre. We used to know the true way of life. The Soviets came to make Afghanistan look like them, but all to no avail. They took over Afghanistan. A 10-year war broke out. The United States came to overthrow the Soviet Union in Afghanistan with American weapons and Afghan lives.
That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
...2 million victims, 4 million wounded, and over 5 million refugees were the result of a decade-long war between the two superpowers in Afghanistan. Defeated, the Soviet Union had to leave. Now, the Afghans spoke only the language of war and conflict. Destruction and killing continued for another 4 years, and then came the Taliban and its aftermath. The United States invaded and occupied Afghanistan in the name of fighting terrorism. It was supposed to bring democracy, freedom, and prosperity for the people, but it turned out to bring only drones, bombing, and suicide. Again, innocent children and women were victims of the aggression. 20 years on, the Americans fled and traded Afghanistan with those they called terrorists. Millions of Afghan refugees have entered Iran legally or illegally over the past 40 years. Some of them were settled in centres called Mehman Shah or Guest City. Some others found refuge in other parts of the country. This is the guest city of Torbatajam. It is located in Iran near the Afghan border. Initially, all asylum seekers who came to the area were housed in tents. Marzieh was born in one such tent. Later on, buildings replaced tents, and the guest city ballooned. Workshops, schools, clinics, banks, and shops were set up to provide better services. A council of Afghans themselves run the place. This is also called the Little Afghanistan. Marzieh grew up with the guest city. Ghulam Habib was hardly 16 when he came to Iran to work. He found a job in a foundry with a minimum wage. In Afghanistan, he had only learnt to read and write, but he continued his studies inside Iran. He took a liking to karate and played sports alongside his work to open his own sports club afterwards. Amir Ali's parents had taken refuge in Iran from Afghanistan. He was born in Iran. Amir Ali loved school and got into university to study medicine and then took an orthopedic specialist course. Dr. Amir Karimi also successfully completed a subspecialty in knee surgery. Hugging me wholeheartedly. A child born in the border tents of the Iranian Red Crescent. I am the child of the border. My name is Najiba. I studied psychology, but my main interest in filmmaking led me to study cinema directing at the Iranian Youth Cinema Society. My Iranian friends encouraged and helped me to make films. Maybe if it weren't for their support, I would have given up filmmaking. I am concerned with the troubles of Afghan refugees. I go to them to document their life story. Alijan lost his mother in Afghanistan when he was only 9. He came to Iran with his father, brothers, and sister. He finished elementary school before dropping out and going to work. In the meantime, an Iranian teenager named Mohammed worked alongside Alijan. For years, they both worked in a sewing workshop. They were far apart and did not know each other. John Jafari and Mohammad Kassai met many years later. They made a decision that changed the course of their lives and that of their colleagues. Mr. Murtaza Afzali's family went through a terrible patch after his father was killed. At the age of 18, he came to Iran alone to work and support his family. Mr. Afzali liked to study and have a university degree, but a refugee is often doomed to a certain few choices given their conditions. Following years of hard work and improved living conditions, and after finding a small workshop, he decided to quit his job and pursue this new profession without knowing much about it. In the 40 years that Afghans have sought refuge in Iran, the Iranian people have experienced the worst downturn in history. Saddam's invasion of Iran, which lasted 8 years, and the most difficult of all, the cruel sanctions imposed by the United States on the Iranian people, dubbed by many as the most severe sanctions in the history of any nation. Afghans are not the first migrants to flock to Iran. During World War II, a torrent of 116,000 Polish refugees rushed to the Persian territory. Despite its neutrality in the war, Iran was occupied by the Soviet Union and Britain, which led to a severe famine for the Iranian people. Nevertheless, they welcomed the hunger and disease-stricken asylum seekers from Poland. When Iraq invaded Iran, Saddam had shelled his country's Kurdish region with chemical bombs, massacring thousands of fellow Iraqis. The survivors of the attacks took refuge in Iran. As usual, the Iranians welcomed them with open arms. Every time the United States invaded Iraq, thousands of Iraqis took shelter in Iran. Marzia's family stayed in the guest city and built their own Afghanistan here. The security and hospitality services in the guest city led to the formation of new families and an upturn in its population. More than 3.5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran, legally or illegally. All legal asylum seekers benefit from public health insurance. Supporting the Iranian nation football team is an integral part of the Ahmadi family's life. Most asylum seekers, to whatever country they go to, start life from scratch. Their efforts must be many times more than any ordinary citizen in order to achieve their desired goals. Go to a man who has achieved what he loved. His expertise has led him to start and expand this family business. Mr. Alavi is an Afghan refugee. When he came to Iran 33 years ago, he started working in a box-making workshop. He recollects the vicissitudes of living in Iran, but does admit that there has been more help and kindness for him to get to where he is today.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In recent years, global warming has become a major environmental problem. Many of us are always faced with news relating to the global warming, and we hear warnings about the worsening situation. As time passes, we will experience the effects of global warming on our lives. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Britain's Met Office predicts next year is forecast to be one of the hottest on record, with global average temperatures forecast to be above 1.2 degrees Celsius, above what they were before humans started to drive climate change. If correct, it will be the 10th year in a row to see global average temperatures reach at least 1 degree Celsius above what they were used to be in pre-industrial times, measured as the period 1850 to 1900. The current hottest year on record, dating back to 1850, is 2016, a year that saw an El Niño climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which pushes up global temperatures on top of global warming trends. Professor Adam Scaife, head of long-range predictions at the Met Office, said, "Without a preceding El Niño to boost global temperatures, 2023 may not be a record-breaking year, but with the background increase in global greenhouse gas emissions continuing apace, it is likely that next year will be another notable year in the series." The Met Office's Dr. Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific." Dr. Nick Dunstan added, "La Niña has a temporary cooling effect on global average temperature. For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the 3 consecutive years with La Niña state, with a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific." Dr. Dunstan said, "This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Dr. Douglas Smith, a leading Met Office expert in climate prediction, added, "The fact that global average temperatures are at or above 1 degree Celsius for a decade masks the considerable temperature variation across the world." Dr. Douglas Smith said, "Some locations, such as the Arctic, have warmed by several degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times." The Met Office is forecasting a global average temperature of between 1.08 degrees Celsius and 1.32 degrees Celsius above what it was in the second half of the 19th century. Last year, the Met Office predicted 2022's global temperature will be between 0.97 degrees Celsius and 1.21 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, with a central estimate of 1.09 degrees Celsius. Data for the year to October suggests the temperature is about 1.16 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial era. Meanwhile, the Hindustan Times has also reported on the same story. The team, coordinated by the United Kingdom's Meteorological Office, in their first 5-year general outlook, said there is a 93% chance that the world will set in a record for hottest year by the end of 2026. Teams of meteorologists across the globe predicted the world is creeping closer to the warming threshold international agreements are trying to prevent, with nearly a 50-50 chance that Earth will temporarily hit that temperature mark within the next 5 years. A team of 11 different forecast centres predicted for the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, recently, with human-made climate change continuing, there's a 48% chance that the globe will reach a yearly average temperature of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels of the late 1800s at least once between now and 2026, a bright red signal in climate change negotiations and climate science. Britain's Met Office senior scientist Leon Hermanson, who coordinated the report, said, "We're going to see continued warming in line with what is expected with climate change. Those forecasts are big-picture global and regional climate predictions on a yearly and seasonal timescale based on long-term averages and state-of-the-art computer simulations. They're different than increasingly accurate weather forecasts that predict how hot or how wet a certain day will be in specific places. But even if the world hits that mark of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, the globe has already warmed about 1.1 degrees Celsius, or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since the late 1800s. That's not quite the same as the global threshold first set by international negotiators in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In 2018, a major United Nations science report predicted dramatic and dangerous effects on people and the world if warming exceeds 1.5 degrees Celsius. Several scientists said the global 1.5 degree threshold is about the world being that warm, not for 1 year, but over a 20 or 30 year time period. This is not what the report predicts. Hermansen said meteorologists can only tell if Earth hits that average mark year, maybe a decade or two, after it is actually reached there, because it is a long-term average. Climate scientist Zeke Hofstra of the tech company Stripper and Berkeley Earth, who wasn't part of the forecast team, said the prediction makes sense given how warm the world already is, and an additional tenth of a degree Celsius, nearly 2/10 of a degree Fahrenheit, is expected because human-caused climate change in the next 5 years. And to add, the likelihood of a strong El Niño, the natural period warming of parts of the Pacific Ocean that alter world weather, which could toss another couple of tenths of a degree on top of that temporarily, and the world gets very close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The English website of Al Jazeera Network has also reported on the same story. A new United Nations report has found that the past 8 years were the 8 hottest ever recorded, indicating the world is now deep into the climate crisis. It said the internationally agreed 1.5 degrees Celsius limit for global heating is now barely within reach. The report by the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, WMO, set out how record high greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are driving sea level and ice melting to new highs and supercharging extreme weather from Pakistan to Puerto Rico. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that the global average temperature in 2022 will be about 1.15 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial average, meaning every year since 2016 has been one of the warmest years on record. For the past 2 years, the natural La Niña climate phenomena has actually kept global temperatures lower than they would otherwise have been. The inevitable switch back to El Niño conditions will see temperatures surge even higher in the future, on top of global heating.
Football in the media. Over 400 years have passed since the first newspaper was printed in the history of mankind. Now, newspapers have become something very ordinary in our daily lives. Even if we don't buy it, sometimes we stand by the newsstand and take a look at the headlines and the pictures. Every day, over 300 million copies of newspapers are sold throughout the world. Political, cultural, ideological, and yellow press, and those about the minorities, and of course, sports newspapers. Who can deny that the largest numbers of issues are for sports newspapers? seeing a football player's picture and a controversial headline on the front page of a newspaper will tempt anyone to buy a copy of it. It's true, most of the analysis and news items in sports dailies are about football. But the story isn't that simple. Now, there are millions of sites on the internet that are about football news and analysis. From the sites that cover the news about a club or even a player to credible sites that have a half